Here's to Your Health, a contemporary Catholic health program that brings you the latest in healthcare trends and breakthroughs. Join Dr. Carla Calumet every Wednesday at 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. on Iowa Catholic Radio. And now, here's to your health.
And welcome to Here's to Your Health. I'm Dr. Carla, and today our guest is Peter G. Levine. In the United States, someone has a stroke every 40 seconds, and every 4 minutes, someone dies of a stroke. Peter G. Levine is an American medical researcher, science educator, and authority on stroke recovery. His articles have been published extensively in peer-reviewed journals on brain plasticity as it relates to stroke, with an emphasis on modified constraint-induced therapy. And we are going to talk with Peter today about stroke and his book, Stronger After Stroke. So I would like to welcome you, Peter, to our show today. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Dr. Carla.
You know, in looking at your book, Stronger After Stroke, what was it that, you know, motivated you to write a book of this type? Can you tell us a little bit about that journey and where that came about?
Wow, what a great question. What a beautiful softball question that is. So, I think like a lot of people, I struggle with a lot of things in life. And one of the things I struggled with was school. I always had a hard time. When I started working with stroke survivors and saw how people generally treated people with brain injury, it kind of, I don't know, made me a little bit angry. So my book was, and a lot of my work is a response to wanting to support people who struggle intellectually in some way.
So and
I don't care if they struggle intellectually or they're struggling with movement or what it is, that struggle is what interests me. And so that's what motivated me to write the book.
And what comes to my mind is that it's almost like vulnerable populations, even the elderly, that in my own experience when I worked as a hospice director, sometimes the elderly are treated as though they have with a lack of dignity, for lack of a better word. So what I'm thinking is that, and at least what I'm hearing you say, is this is a way of empowering people who have had a stroke.
I think so. That's the main idea behind a lot of our lab's work, the book, a lot of the talks I do to clinicians is how can people take the ball, do it by themselves, not spend a lot of money doing it, not have to pay clinicians necessarily to do it, although they can be helpful at times.
Right.
But exactly.
So, you know, I'm thinking of my mother's own experience, and a lot of people who are listening to us have had family members. And I know when we recently spoke, you said your sister had also experienced a stroke. And it's a shock. I know we were called in the middle of the night by my mother, who was a nurse, telling me she had just had a stroke. And her voice, of course, was slurred. And the shock of what the diminishment is it's huge. And so what I'm thinking is, you know, can you tell our listeners as far as just, you know, at the beginning of the journey, what they need to know and how they can support their loved one who's experienced a stroke and step them through that?
Absolutely. The beginning of the journey will start at the first symptom of stroke. It's essential that stroke survivors get to the hospital immediately. Here at University of Cincinnati, an RN here developed the FAST test, face, arm, speech, and time. If you see somebody who looks like they're in distress and you ask them to smile, face, and only one side of the mouth comes up, that's an indication of stroke. Arm, that you ask them to lift both arms in front of them, if one starts to drift off by itself, that's a sign of stroke. Speech, you ask them to say something. We have this joke, it has to have the word Cincinnati in there someplace, like I am from Cincinnati, or whatever you want them to repeat. If they can't do it, they got to get to the hospital. And then time, of course, is the fact that they have to get to the hospital in time. There are drugs that can be administered almost immediately that can help people recover immediately and walk out of the hospital a couple days later like they never had one, but it has to be done very soon. So the initial idea is to know that you're having a stroke. Once they have a stroke and they get into the hospital, and if they have a stroke, they're going to work very hard to clear the clot. Once
right.
they clear the
I just have a quick question because, you know, that was our issue when we took my mother to the hospital, is that she had gone to sleep and she wasn't sure when she had the stroke. And so that infamous clot buster that they can give, there's a window of time. Can you tell our listeners about that?
It's called tissue plasminogen activator, but nobody calls it that. Everybody calls it TPA.
Okay.
TPA has to be administered within the first 3 hours. It is not uncommon for stroke survivors to report that they had their stroke during their sleep, just like your mom.
Okay.
And once that happens, it makes it tough to let anybody know that you're having a stroke, because even you don't know you're having a stroke until the next morning you try to get out of bed, go to the bathroom, and you fall over or something.
Right, right. So that's just the clinician's choice, then, if that's the case when you arrive at the ER, right?
Absolutely. They will make that decision.
Okay, good. So then the next steps are?
The next step is, you know, you'll have a bunch of therapists in there evaluating you almost immediately. And the next steps are literally steps. They'll try to get you up out of bed, taking a few steps. If you can't do that, they'll just have you roll over. If you can't do that, they'll try to talk to you. But immediately after the stroke, they're trying to evaluate where you're going to be in 2 weeks, 2 months, and 2 years.
Okay.
Eventually, you'll get discharged from the hospital. The average length of stay in the United States is about 5.5 days.
And that was something that you had some consternation about, that compared to other countries, we have a very short stay here in the U.S.
The average length of stay, and I think we talked about this before, in the Netherlands is about a month for a stroke survivor in the hospital.
Okay.
In the rest of Europe, it's about 20 days. So we get them out very rapidly, which is good news and bad news. I mean, generally speaking, you don't want somebody to lie around the hospital too long, but Europeans and other countries understand that there's this continuum of care to get them out of the hospital and into the next step. Ours tends to be, here in the United States, more disjointed, so they might go from the hospital to a skilled nursing facility, or they might go to a rehab hospital, or they might go directly home. And all three of those provide different kinds of things for different kinds of stroke survivors.
Okay, so I know in our experience with my mother that she went into an inpatient rehab facility and was there for, I believe it was about 3 weeks, and then she was discharged home and had follow-up physical therapy and speech therapy and occupational therapy at home. So I'm thinking that she was one of the fortunate people, but I do remember that they discharged a young man that was 18 years old in that same rehab facility, that he wasn't engaging in any of the rehab activity. Now, can you tell us a little bit about what the expectation is of the patient in a rehab unit, and would a discharge be then because somebody wasn't following the schedule of rehab, or how does that work?
You're exactly right. Once they're discharged to a rehab hospital, they have to be able to do 3 hours a day of pretty intensive rehab. If they can't do that, as the young man in your scenario was suggested, refuses to do it, then they are discharged out of the rehab hospital. But the fact that your mom went there to begin with, she is one of the lucky few. Most people get sent to skilled nursing or to home.
Okay.
Once they're at the rehab hospital, they have to work really hard. Then they work hard, and hopefully they get better and better and better. That usually lasts, a couple weeks, sometimes a little bit longer. If they continue to get better, they stay on caseload. But if they plateau and it appears to the therapist that they're not getting better, they're discharged to home, and then sometimes they get home care, as it sounds like happened with your mother.
Right. My interest, too, is we're seeing strokes at younger ages. And in your research, do you have any remarks you can make about why we're seeing strokes at younger ages?
Absolutely. So there's a higher percentage of younger people having stroke, both just because there's a higher percentage, there's more young people having stroke, and that has to do with diet, it has to do with illicit drugs, it has to do with lifestyle choices.
Okay.
But mostly diet. At the same time, though, among older stroke survivors, or older people generally, that is above 65, those numbers have peaked and actually come down in the United States. So less older people are having strokes, not significantly less. Let's just say it's plateaued.
All right.
But for younger people, it's continued to go up. And it's a special kind of evil that stroke rocks on a young stroke survivor, because they still have their entire life in front of them. They're raising kids, they're running their business, and so they're often much more motivated to scratch and claw their way back to recovery when they're young. So in some ways a lot funner to work with younger stroke survivors, just because they are highly motivated.
Well, I think that in our recent conversation, you were talking about that they kind of have broken the barrier of where plateau is, right? They've pushed that and gone beyond what possibly the thought recovery they could attain would be. Is that right? Did I understand that right?
I think that's generally true. You know, you have a young stroke survivor that's 27 years old, maybe they're college educated, they're in their middle of their career, they have a family. Those people are often discharged from traditional therapy, but they don't stop. They continue on. And we learn a tremendous amount from these young stroke survivors who are educated. They can figure out things in research, and they're always looking for something new, whatever will push them through the latest plateau. So, yeah, we learn a lot from that population.
And I want to go back to your book and the purpose of your book. It was very interesting how this came into my life, and I really thought it was a God incident, because I had interviewed you at another radio company on my health program, and it was within weeks that my mother suffered a serious stroke. And literally, she read this entire book and felt that it supported her very much through her journey. So I want our listeners to remember that the book is Stronger After Stroke, and it's by Peter G. Levine. And also, Peter, can you tell us about your blog and your Facebook, where people can go ahead and follow you as well? I want to get that in before we have further questions.
Absolutely. So the blog, if you just go to Google and Google Stronger After Stroke blog, you'll find it. It'll be the first hit.
Okay.
And yeah, and on there, my email address is on there. I encourage stroke survivors to email me if they have any questions.
Wonderful. And right now you're at Ohio State Brain Lab. And can you tell us about what we're seeing? Is there any cutting edge research happening that really can provide hope for people?
You know, there's so much stuff happening. Right now we're involved in a clinical trial. It's called a wearable robotic.
Okay.
If you remember Sigourney Weaver, when she wore the big suit to amplify her movements in the movie Aliens, which I'm sure you didn't watch. It's a terrible movie. But it's that kind of deal where if the stroke survivor attempts a movement, the machine picks up what that attempt is and then amplifies it.
Okay.
So that's what, yeah.
So technology is going to play a role in helping stroke survivors is what I'm hearing.
It is, but I should point out that a lot of these technologies are still in their infancy. We're still waiting for them to come to fruition. So that's what we're working hard on.
Okay. I was looking at the numbers as far as what the expenses for stroke, and they're indicating that stroke costs the United States an estimated $34 billion each year. And what I'd like to ask you is, if you were the person in charge of allocating this money, is there a way that you would allocate it differently to be able to help support stroke survivors?
Wow, that's an amazingly good question. Let me just back up a little bit.
Okay.
Your numbers are absolutely correct. What's probably more significant is the amount of cost that for an individual to have a stroke. So
okay.
What does it cost the individual? And the estimates are about $150,000 to $160,000, but that estimate does not take into account the work lost and all the ancillary expenses that it's going to take to have a stroke. So it's incredibly financially debilitating. And I guess to answer your second question, that's the way I would answer it, the same way I answered the first one. We should probably support people with brain injury more than we do, as they flow back into society and try to get their back their life, back to, you know, raising their family and running their businesses, et cetera. I think it's the transitional stuff from rehab, per se, to life that I would spend more money on.
Okay. Can you also, well, and one of the things that I find interesting is that a lot of people, getting home was a big motivating factor in my mother's stroke experience. She wanted to be back in her home, and she was in her early 80s when she had this stroke. And I found that she would work as hard as she possibly could because her goal was getting back in her home, and she did. And she did very well. But what I found interesting was the constant back and forth around physician orders of getting the therapy that she still needed in the home. So do you feel there's enough money allocated to support the people that are wanting to have therapy in their home?
You know, generally the lament among just about every stroke survivor is that there's not enough therapy, whether it's at home or in a facility, outpatient, wherever it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a balance because therapy is very expensive.
Right.
I'm a therapist. I'm married to a therapist. Look, we cost a lot of money. And then the physiatry and neurology and all the doctors.
Right.
But, you know, you get a certain number of days per year of therapy, and then that's it. And then you're kind of off this cliff into trying to do everything yourself. So I do think, although therapy is expensive, it's worthwhile to go back every once in a while and have the therapist help you push through whatever plateau you're on, and then you do some stuff by yourself, go back to therapy, and then push through the next plateau and repeat that process.
So possibly what I'm hearing is it's just good on a interval basis to go to the therapist and get more guidance on how they can do further therapy at home. Right?
That's exactly what I advocate. Yeah.
Okay.
You don't always need a therapist there to tell you to do every little thing.
Right.
If you're motivated, like it sounds like your mom was real motivated. She was reading books, you know, she's pushing the issues. She was doing what she needed to do to get back her life.
Right.
And if you have that motivation, you know, you can have a stroke that's so bad, it can obliterate somebody's motivation. They get depressed. They get unmotivated. They just sit there and they stare out the window for the rest of their life. That's
right.
Never good. As long as they have the motivation, that's the clear incentive.
And, you know, I'd be amiss if I didn't mention this because we're on Iowa Catholic Radio listening to Here's to Your Health with Dr. Carla. And one of the things that did help my mother tremendously was her prayer life. She had a tremendous devotion, and she prayed very hard to have the strength and the will to be able to move through. Because, as you say, it's very easy for people to become depressed and wondering. And I can't imagine if you're an 18-year-old or in your 20s. I know when I was teaching at one of the colleges, a young girl in her 20s had a stroke. And just to have to try to organize and make sense of what does this mean within your life if you have a family, children, all the people that depend on you or your workplace, it's tremendously overwhelming. And I can imagine that it would be very easy to be depressed. So I would want to also say that spiritual component, I believe, from what I saw, at least in my own personal journey with my mom, very much supported her to have the ambition and motivation to want to do her best to work through. And then getting back to what you were talking about, working at home, I think that was part of what she did, is that when her therapist came, then she had everything written down, and they brought a lot of paperwork to show her different movements that she could do in between visits that she did diligently. So there again, I think that was extremely important. You have in your book area that's called Those Amazing Machines. Can you talk to us a little bit about what recovery machines are?
Well, it's anything outside of you that helps drive recovery. Sometimes they are robots. Sometimes they're wearable robots. Sometimes it's a virtual reality machine where you are playing kind of like the Xbox Kinect or the Wii, where you're playing a game and therefore eliciting more movement. We use a lot of electrical stimulation machines.
Okay.
Electrical stimulation internally is the way that your brain communicates with your muscles. If your brain can't because of the stroke, we can use machines to help facilitate. It's a sort of an external nervous system, if you will. So there's a ton of different machines out there that we're working with.
And you're at the University of Cincinnati, correct?
Well, our lab has a long history. It gets complicated. We're now at Ohio State.
Okay.
You know, Columbus,
okay.
Ohio, yes.
Right, right. So if a person wanted to be able to come there, is that a possibility that they can do that? Or as far as research candidates, can you tell us a little bit about how you have your population of people that participate in your research?
Absolutely. And I'm going to do two things. One is, if you are interested in doing clinical research and you're a stroke survivor, feel free to email me at strongerafterstroke@yahoo.com. And you can always, you know, we'll see if you can qualify for one of our clinical trials. However, I want to give you something else. If you go to www.clinicaltrials.gov, so clinical trials is just one word, www.clinicaltrials.gov, G-O-V, you'll find all, and they basically just ask you to type in your zip code. You'll find all the clinical trials in your geographic area so that you don't have to travel to Ohio or to New York or to California. What's going on in your neighborhood? Again, clinicaltrials.gov.
You'll
get all the clinical trials in your area.
Wonderful. And we do have a few medical schools in our state, but particularly I'm thinking the University of Iowa. Hospitals have a lot of ongoing research, so possibly that would be one of the places that they might find something like that. If you had one positive comment to make to our listeners who have suffered from a stroke, what would that be, Peter?
Look, you've had challenges before in your life, and you didn't give up before. Why would you quit now? Everybody's struggling in a variety of ways. I have my problems. Everybody in my family has their problems. We all struggle against these every day. Don't let the stroke get in your way. It's just another thing they have to overcome, and that's about the best advice I can give.
And we could probably end with just two, also giving the information on neuroplasticity that years ago they thought when you had a stroke, that was it. You couldn't recover, but, you know, we're understanding now how the neural connections can find new pathways. Can you just briefly mention something about that?
When the entire human brain has about 100 billion neurons, it's not an important number, but it's a lot, 100 billion. The average stroke kills about 2% of that, about 2 billion. That's an average stroke, but still, that's a very tiny amount of brain that dies in the average stroke in a system that's completely redundant to itself. So there's all this backup. It's unlike any other organ in your body. If your heart blows a valve, that heart is done with. You've got to get that valve replaced. But in the brain, there's this all these redundancies in the brain that will take over. But here's where the will comes in. You have to have the will to push the brain into a new, uncomfortable, but productive area. That pushing is what rewires the brain neuroplastically.
And it's almost, you know, from what I saw in my personal experience with my mom, it's relearning. It is really retraining and relearning how to eat, for example, how to lift the utensils even to your mouth. And I was absolutely amazed at the progress, and I do think that it took a lot of will to be able to do that. Peter, I want to thank you so much for joining us again on Here's to Your Health. I hope that our listeners find value from all of the information that you've shared with us today, and that they will not give up, but they will be, as your book says, stronger after stroke. Thank you again for joining us, and I hope you'll come back and be on our show again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Carla.
Here's to Your Health, a contemporary Catholic health program that brings you the latest in healthcare trends and breakthroughs. Join Dr. Carla Calumet every Wednesday at 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. on Iowa Catholic Radio. Now, live your life for God, and here's to your health.